Grab your trowel and a cup of coffee, as you're listening to Archaeo Cafe. I'm your host, Otis Crandell. Welcome to another episode of Archaeo Cafe. I'm Otis, and today I'm talking with Robert Losey at the University of Alberta in Edmonton, Canada. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Otis. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here today. One thing I'm always interested in when I meet new archaeologists is how it all got started. What first got you interested in archaeology?
I've been asked this question before, and I don't know that I really have a particularly compelling answer for that question. I think really I started university as a major in biological sciences and was taking, you know, just general classes. And I had a course in archaeology, Introduction to Archaeology. And I really liked it. And then I just sort of drifted over the next year or two into doing archaeology and ended up going to field school very early when I was an undergraduate student and enjoyed it. And that's how I got into it. There's unfortunately not an interesting or a romantic story about this whole process. Yeah.
Well, I think there's a lot of archaeologists, particularly people in the archaeometry type fields that come in from other fields. I think it really adds a lot of interesting research into archaeology when people come in from another background, because they bring in some of the methods or the ideas or the theories from those fields. And so they get incorporated into archaeology over time. So.
Yeah. I agree. I started out in biosciences. My interests were developed in graduate school into zooarchaeology, and that for me was an outgrowth both of starting out in biological sciences, mm-hmm. but also growing up on a cattle ranch. I worked as a butcher for a while. Those things influenced my course of study over the long term, strangely enough.
What is the most interesting place that you've worked as an archaeologist?
That, for me, is pretty easy to answer. The most interesting place I've worked is in the Yamal region in Siberia, Arctic Siberia. Mm-hmm. And I say that because 2 or 3 years ago, we were working on some artifacts related to harnessing reindeer in this region. And part of our approach to understanding those objects was to do, consultation with people who are reindeer herders today, Nenets folks that live in Yamal. They live mobile lifestyles with their reindeer. And we had this amazing opportunity to replicate the archaeological objects that we were working on. And then we lived with herders for about a month on the tundra, which was nothing short of a life-changing experience in terms of just how amazing their way of being is and their friendliness and openness to us. And it changed how I thought about a lot of things, and particularly domestication, which I think we're going to talk about here later.
Did you get a chance to do some reindeer herding yourself, or was it more observational?
Well, it was more observation because basically I don't know anything about reindeer and how to handle them properly. So we were given the jobs for idiots, so to speak. So like we were holding up fences and things like this, and they did let us a few times drive reindeer sleds on the tundra, which was amazing. But, we participated, but I'm not trying to glorify it in any way. We were, literally holding up things. That's basically what we did for reindeer herding.
I suppose it's something they must learn from childhood.
Yes, absolutely. And it requires a lot of skill and a lot of knowledge and experience. And we had none of those things. So, it would have taken a far longer time of living there and interacting with the reindeer to be able to do that in any meaningful way.
But still, even being able to be there watching people doing it instead of just reading about it or hearing about it, that's going to be really a really informative experience to take part in.
It was, and it you know, just the entire experience of living in the cold, mm-hmm. and being so interdependent on this group of animals for your well-being on the tundra. I mean, they were our clothing, they were our shelter, they were our food, and we're kind of bound to them, right? We'd have to move to accommodate their grazing needs and so on. So it was really fantastic.
What are your main areas of interest in the past?
My main areas of interest are people's relationships with animals. Most of that work has involved people's relationships with dogs. So people's lives with dogs, the domestication of dogs, work lives, their diets, their evolution. I spent a lot of time thinking about people's relationships mm-hmm. with dogs, but also do some of this reindeer work, some ethnoarchaeology, a little bit of archaeological theory. But really, I'm most well known, I think, for my dog research.
For our audience, could you tell us, what is domestication?
Well, that is a challenging thing to explain, but, a sort of standard definition of domestication is that it involves human control over or human influence on animal breeding, animal reproduction mm-hmm. over multiple generations. And, that being said, a lot of that definition is misleading, false and incomplete. Domestication really is this kind of long-term relationship, intimate relationship that people develop with another animal or plant or insect, so much so that the animal, its evolution changes to adapt to living with humans. And some of that change involves the intentional things that people do to animals by controlling their breeding in various ways. And a lot of it is unintentional, that they just adapt to eating our foods and living in environments that we have modified through other things that we do during our life. So it's really multiple things. Domestication is not a single process, especially when we look at, we know that domestication is applied to animals like or things like silkworms and horses, and they're entirely different creatures, but we call their relationship with humans domestication. So it's really a varied set of relationships.
So you've talked in the past about domestication being thought of as an ongoing process rather than a threshold event. Could you elaborate a bit on that?
Yeah, maybe it's at least a century now, people have described domestication as a revolution, as mm-hmm. this thing that happened suddenly, and that it was massively transformative for the animals involved and the human societies that were involved. And this line of thinking has been, it's like impossible to rid ourselves of, but it's fundamentally false, because the processes of domestication are long-term, they're evolutionary processes, they're social processes, and they're ongoing processes. But, in the media and even in archaeological literature, people still describe it as a transformative event. And it is not an event at all, but rather a process or this kind of history of entanglement between mm-hmm. people and certain animals mm-hmm. or plants. I mean, really, like with dogs, people say, when were dogs domesticated? And what they mean by this is, when did dogs first enter into this intimate relationship with people? Mm-hmm. But we have to understand, though, that that relationship is still evolving. Dogs are still being domesticated because we're still involved in their reproduction. We're still involved in their lives. And I would also add to this, we think of domestication really as a one-way street, like something that people did to plants, animals, and other living things. But in fact, it's much more of a multi-directional relationship in that we're affecting each other's histories, each other's evolutions through time. So all of that rather unilennial kind of threshold thinking has been around for a long time, and it needs to be thrown out. And a lot of people now recognize that, I think.
So why do archaeologists and historians often interpret domestication as a revolution?
I think it's in part salesmanship, because you know, if one is trying to explain, you know, why one is studying the domestication of horses or of cattle or cats or whatever, the selling point is that that is an important thing for all of humanity, right? It transformed the world, and it sounds better perhaps in people's thinking as a revolution or an ongoing process. So I think part of it is we still think of it as a revolution, and maybe that goes all the way back to, you know, people like V. Gordon Childe, who talked about the Neolithic revolution, urban revolution, and all of these things. And it just, it's like it's stuck in our head, but we need to get past that idea.
Yeah. What are some of the flaws of this interpretation as a revolution?
Well, one of the flaws with the idea of domestication as a revolution is that when you look at the history of any particular domesticated plant or animal, we don't see some particular signature in those animals or plants, you know, biological makeup that is where that plant or animal crosses a distinct threshold where it becomes in a different state. What we see is continual change, continual evolution, sometimes periods of stability, but there's no identifiable threshold in, you know, changing genomes or changing body forms that indicates that an animal has become domestic. And in fact, even though we see all of this continual change, it's actually really difficult to attribute most of it or any of it to human intention. I mean, we can see the change, we can document the change, and we know that the change might have led to the animals that we have today, but whether it's the result of just the animals adapting to new environments or to changing because of human choices is unclear. So we see evolution, not revolution, in domesticated plants and animals and insects.
I guess another problem is that some of the changes aren't going to be preserved in the fossil record or the archaeological record. Some behavioral changes in the animals that may have preceded physical changes, these might not be so clearly or easily interpreted based on the archaeological paleontological record.
Yes, and you know, in fact, there are probably far more changes occur in these plants and animals, and you know, in dogs in particular, that leave no material traces, right? So we can't read as of yet changes in, you know, animals' season of reproduction, for example, in skeletal remains. Maybe at some point we'll be able to tease some of this apart with some sort of genetic signature, but that's yet to happen. You know, as archaeologists, we're not so much interested in explaining the physical changes in animals during domestication, for example. Mm-hmm. What we're interested in is their relationship with people. So dogs may have, or if you want to call them early dogs or wolves that live with people, they may have been, you know, intimate, closely living with humans, hunting, cooperating, you know, being companions to humans for thousands of years before exhibiting any discernible changes in their body shapes or their genetics. So what we're trying to get at is not those physical changes, but the relationship changes, and the relationship changes are really challenging to tease out of the archaeological record.
I was thinking about the Fox experiment in Russia, where after 60 years, they had foxes which they naturally behave different and interact with humans different than their wild ancestors from 60 years ago.
Right.
But physically, they look like a fox. And I don't think you would see any difference if you looked at just the physical remains of them compared to a wild fox. But still, there was clearly some sort of change that had occurred in the animal. You have a different population than what you started with quite a few generations back.
Yeah, and that is one of the most important experiments that's ever been done, trying to understand how the bodily changes of domestication come about, like how that might have occurred by just, essentially keeping friendly animals around. And you keep friendly foxes around in this case and let them breed with one another in a very controlled laboratory setting, and didn't take too many generations. And then you saw foxes that were generally quite tame. Some of them had floppy ears and curved tails and slight changes in coat color, changes in reproductive seasonality and these sorts of things. But in terms of skeletal changes that an archaeologist, a zooarchaeologist might look at, the differences are probably minor, if not undetectable. They're very, very subtle. And again, that may also be the case with the domestication of dogs, which was not done in a laboratory setting. It was done in in normal life for people who were gathering at the end of the Ice Age. So it would have been a less strict process, more fluid process, where early dogs were, still interbreeding with animals that were not living with people. And their bodies, if they would have experienced change extremely, extremely slowly, I think.
What are some of the earliest evidences of modern dog domestication?
So the earliest evidence in terms of the bodily changes in dogs would be things like you start to see at the very end of the Pleistocene of the Ice Age and into the early Holocene, dogs appear that are, their body sizes are slightly smaller than wolves on average. Their snouts are rotated upwards relative to their brain cases, so they develop a bit more of a forehead if you're looking at them. The head becomes very slightly smaller relative to the rest of the body compared to wolves. Wolves have a big head compared to the rest of their bodies. Those are the perhaps some of the most reliable differences. There are some declines in the size of the teeth, declines in the length of the limbs, but this is all kind of proportional scaling sorts of differences. So I would say the most reliable one is probably this difference in the kind of rotation of the snout relative to the back of the cranium. But beyond those bodily changes, the other evidence for this emerging relationship is that people start burying dogs. So you see, 14,000 years or so ago, you see a dog or multiple dogs actually being buried at Bonn-Oberkassel in Germany. Not shortly thereafter in parts of the Near East, on the east coast of Russia, and so on. And then as you move into the Holocene, you start to see numerous examples of dogs being buried. Like, they're being given, in some cases, burials like the human dead. They're being treated like members of the community. Mm-hmm. And beyond any physical changes in their bodies, to me, this is the strongest indicator that you have a hybrid community of people and dogs that are living together as one social unit. And the fact that, people are giving those dogs mortuary rights when they die, they're treating them like their own.
Yeah, they're treating them like a member of the community.
Yes. Yeah. Like a person, just an animal form, a person, you know, which presumably means those animals were considered to have an afterlife, to have, you know, a soul, if you will, that, that endured past their death, just like people. I mean, I've worked on dog burials in Siberia that are 7,000-8,000 years old, and the dogs are buried with spoons. They're buried wearing necklaces. In some cases, they're buried in graves where the human remains were pushed to the side and the dog placed in the grave. I mean, it's just like you see people being treated in those places. I mean, it's fascinating look at really the emotional bonds that people had with animals in the past.
So I guess from a lot of the current research, it seems that there was likely a single origin of dogs. What is the evidence for a single origin of dogs?
The best evidence for a single origin of dogs is that genetically, all modern dogs are quite closely related. Dogs did not originate from wolves in the Americas, for example, those wolves are of course closely related to the wolves in Europe and Asia, but they did not contribute to the origin of dogs. So it's really genetics that indicates this, you know, very close shared evolutionary history. So it was either a single population of wolves or a group or a series of very closely related populations of wolves that gave rise to dogs. And I mean, in the latest suggestion is that those populations were perhaps in Siberia, but East Asia, Europe, the Near East have all been suggested as possible origin places. The challenge with pinning that down is that the variability in the genetics of dogs, the genetic variability in wolves, particularly wolves during the Pleistocene, is really poorly understood. We just have very little information about it, so we don't really know which areas of the world, you know, most likely gave rise to dogs.
What are some of the key changes that have occurred in dogs that distinguish them from wolves?
Over the long term, there have been really a suite of changes. So I mentioned earlier, you know, this changes in the shape of the head and the reduction in body size. These are all the kind of things we can see archaeologically. But there are other more critical changes, perhaps, that we don't see evidence for clearly archaeologically. And these would be things like a dog can potentially reproduce at any season of the year, which is very different than a wolf. I mean, a wolf can do this at a very set period of the time, right? They can breed in the breed over a very short period of time. The male wolves only are capable of producing sperm over a very short period of time, so that the seasonality in their births is very, very, very discreet. With dogs, it could be potentially year round. Other changes, I mean, are behavioral or dietary, I suppose. Now, dogs, many dogs, but certainly not all dogs, have the ability to digest starches, for example. And this is, it's a genetically determined trait in dogs that emerged maybe 6,000-7,000 years ago, well into the domestication history of dogs. So animals were living with agricultural people who ate a lot of starches, and that adaptation in dogs took several thousand years to emerge, at least based on our current, the resolution of our data currently. This is something you can pick up genetically. Other things that we would see, surely differences in the social abilities of dogs. I mean, dogs and wolves are very social animals, but you know, their elements of their socialization, their social abilities that are that are different, not wholly different, but substantially different and importantly different. One is that a dog has a great ability to be social outside of its own species, right? Outside of its own kind. I mean, you can socialize a dog with sheep and horses, and they can, that's part of their group. That's who they'll protect. That's who they'll interact with. And that's pretty amazing. And I think one of the most important characteristics that developed in dogs, it allows them to live with us successfully. It allows them to guard livestock successfully, to herd some animals. All of that, I think, is part of these amazing behavioral changes that have emerged in dogs. So it's really a suite of things that differentiates dogs from wolves.
Hmm. And approximately when did some of these changes occur?
So, you know, first I should add here that this is also, you know, very compelling evidence as domestication, as a non-revolutionary process, but an evolutionary process, in that some of these things that distinguish wolves from dogs occurred maybe 10,000 years or more into their history with people. So, for example, their ability to digest starches maybe 7,000 years ago. So thousands of years after agriculture was being practiced in parts of Eurasia. Things like declines in body size, that was a long-term trend that started in the Ice Age and continued through the Holocene. So, you know, in my work in Siberia, by 7,000-8,000 years ago, you see dogs that are substantially smaller than wolves. But over the long term, certainly by 1,000 or 2,000 years ago, the average dog in Siberia is even smaller. So it was a gradual process of body size decline. Some of the other adaptations that we know exist in modern dogs, we don't really know when they appeared in the past, right? Like it's unclear. Well, it's unclear to me anyway, when herding dogs first were abundant. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously this would have to be after people have pastoral lifeways and needed animals to herd. So it's probably middle Holocene, when that form of dog emerged. The other kind of changes, again, are all gradual, I would say, and also very difficult to tease out. A lot of those key behavioral things we just have a hard time demonstrating archaeologically.
Right.
You know, dogs involved in hunting, maybe. We see evidence of that in rock art that's maybe 8,000-9,000 years old in places like Saudi Arabia. But most of those relationships, we're still trying to figure them out.
It seems that part of this ongoing change in them is to adapt them to what the people of that time and place need the dog for, or what role it can potentially play in their community. Like their ability to eat starch. I mean, clearly if you were a hunter-gatherer and you had a large meat diet, this wouldn't be really necessary for a dog to be able to digest large amounts of starch. But when you switch to growing cereals, then it's a definite advantage and it helps them integrate into the community, I guess. So.
Yeah. So, and this is why also that the changes are not uniform, right? Mm-hmm. So you know, even if you look at, let's say you looked at the variability in dog diets using something like stable isotope analyses in Siberia, it's the dog diets are all over the place. So you see dogs, you know, living on the Pacific coast. Well, they have a marine diet, and you go to the boreal forest. Their diets are largely, because they're living with folks who are primarily hunting and gathering, they have a largely terrestrial meat diet. It's you know, game and or fish in some places. But once you see the emergence in southern Siberia of agricultural communities, you start to see shifts in dog diets. Some of them have their isotope values indicate they're eating unusual plants for the area. So things like millet, which has a distinct isotopic signature, it has a different photosynthetic pathway, which means it looks different chemically. But it also means people are growing those plants in the area, and the dogs are either eating that grain or they're eating things that are eating that grain. So their isotope values are different. So and again, it speaks kind of to that, the intimacy of dog and human social and cultural and biological change. It's all kind of interwoven. So that we track each other. We track each other in our migrations and in our evolution, even over the short span of the Holocene.
I know with cats, one of the things that they noticed, even I think as early as the Neolithic period, when likely is when they started their domestication, is they see the intestines change. And the big interpretation is that although the cats were probably eating vermin that were at the sites, and that may have been one of the things that brought them into settlements, that in amongst the human garbage, there was some other stuff that might have been a food source, but it wouldn't have been purely meat like what a wild cat would have eaten, and that over time, the intestines change. But it's them just simply adapting. Nobody selectively bred them for that. It was opportunity. And like you said, it was an unintentional thing, but it was human related.
Yeah.
I think one of the other changes was about the role of wolves within a wolf community and dogs within a human community, that a lot of times we interact with them, but we have different roles within our community. Whereas in a wolf community, if they're hunting, all the wolves might have a very similar job in the hunt. But when a dog is hunting with a human, they may have a specific role. They may chase the animals, they may track the animals, and then the humans might be the one that kills it. The dog or the pre-dog may benefit from it.
Yeah.
I thought it was another interesting thing that clearly at some point must have occurred.
Yeah. I mean, one of the ways that you can infer some of those changes is actually through body size, because in parts of the world, by the early Holocene, dogs have changed to the point where they're substantially smaller than wolves. And if you look at carnivores in general, once they get below a certain size, they become most adept at hunting animals of a different size. So if a carnivore that's over a certain size threshold, let's say 60, 70 pounds, they tend to hunt animals that are far bigger than themselves. Mm-hmm. Whereas carnivores below that size threshold tend to focus on prey far smaller than themselves. Hmm. So their physical abilities have changed through domestication. And this is an indication and an adaptation probably to, it's just a different set of food environments that they're inhabiting. They now maybe have to focus less on being like a takedown predator versus something, you know, their skill set then becomes tracking and smelling and stopping. Hmm. Prey, and they have another species to hunt with. So rather than investing in having a big body and a strong jaw, they can, the evolution selects for a smaller body and a reduced head size. You know, the animal becomes more like a scavenger than a predator. But really is doing both predation and hunting, but hunting in a new way with humans.
Right. What are some of the notable routes of migration to Siberia that we see based on dog types? When did these occur? What effect did these have on dog populations in Siberia?
Well, there are a few that seem to, a few human migrations involving Siberia that are traceable through dog genetics, meaning that people and their dogs are traveling together and then intermixing with dogs that are already in place and living with people. So one would be multiple migrations actually out of Siberia into the Americas. So those migrations involved also involved migrations of dogs, least 11,000 years ago, or 10,000-11,000 years ago, we see dogs in the Americas. Those dogs genetically are clearly linked to Siberian dog populations. Another one that's very clear is the movement of Inuit people, the direct ancestors of the Inuit people of the Arctic, out of the Bering Strait area, so Chukotka, coastal Alaska, across the North American Arctic, clear to Greenland, clearly also occurred with their dogs. And then there are periods in Siberia itself where you have migrants coming in from the steppe or from Europe that push into Central Asia, Southern Siberia. Probably after 5,000-6,000 years ago, you start to see dogs in Siberia with European ancestry, clear European ancestry. Mm-hmm. Although it's very complicated, it's, you know, European dogs are a mix of various strains, and what you see really is just almost continual moving, shifting populations of people and dogs in Eurasia that makes it very, very, very complicated. And then in the late Holocene in Western Siberia, you appear to see movements of people from the kind of Altai region of Siberia, so down in Central Asia, or in parts of Southeast Europe that are moving north into the Arctic. Perhaps Samoyedic-speaking folks coming up from the south into the north and bringing with them new dogs. Some of those dogs eventually became the Samoyed breed that we have today as a breed dog. So it's shift after shift in multiple directions of people and dogs in Eurasia.
It's interesting, though, that we can use it as another tool to look at the movement of people or even the lifestyles of people. I know that there's some people now working on using dogs or dog remains at archaeological sites as a proxy for studying the humans that lived there.
Yes.
Because the dogs were eating similar stuff. And they would have migrated with the people that lived there. So it is really interesting that we can use them. Instead of looking at human remains, we can still get a lot of information from the dogs themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. A colleague of mine, Eric Geary, called this the canine surrogacy approach. And it's like using dogs in place of humans, using dog remains in place of human remains, where it's, you know, ethically not acceptable to work with human remains. In some places, it is acceptable to work with the remains of dogs. So people have turned to them. And yeah, like, generally, dog diets look like human diets, and generally, large population movements, certainly during the Holocene, involved people and their dogs and other livestock in many cases. So, yeah, it really speaks to the fact that we live in multi-species communities and that we can look at all those species individually in some cases to understand the histories of the others that they were living with. Mm.
In what ways have dogs changed and the domestication process continued after migration to North America?
Well, there are a number of changes, I think, and I don't think particularly well studied, but there are some recent papers published showing that some portions of North America, for example, have quite differently sized dogs than others. Mm-hmm. So parts of the Mountain West have quite big dogs, probably for hauling loads. And this is, you know, a mix of intentional and probably unintentional selection for dogs that are good at doing that particular task. Mm-hmm. So you see the evolution of new forms of dogs. Probably the most interesting example comes from the West Coast of Canada, where you see Indigenous folks there develop through breeding the woolly dog, and this is a smallish dog with very long kind of downy hair, People bred those dogs for shearing, and they would weave the hair of those dogs. And that particular form of dog, you know, emerged somewhere in the middle to late Holocene. So there was, you know, this differentiation of dogs in the Americas. Clearly, the histories of many of the different types of dogs we don't know very well archaeologically, but ethnographically, we see some of them that are quite well documented. I mean, Mesoamerica certainly developed, and I assume also South America, their own, you know, unique and interesting forms of dogs through, you know, just this continuation of the domestication process. Hairless dogs, in the Arctic, dogs for pulling sleds, even Inuit dogs, which entered the Arctic, let's say Canada and Greenland in the last 1,000 years, even those are different than dogs elsewhere in the Arctic. So the dogs in Greenland over the last 1,000 years are noticeably larger than the dogs in Canada or Alaska on average. So again, there's this continued evolutionary change, selection for a larger body size in that particular area. So lots going on in the Americas, and lots still to figure out.
And it's happening right now. I mean, when we were training dogs for specific jobs.
Yes.
Over several generations, people know the parents of that dog were good at a specific task. The grandparents were really good at that task. And we record these now. We have dog competitions and stuff where we record how good the dogs were. So you can look at the lineage. And if you have a dog that's descended of other dogs which were really good at a particular task, whether because physically they had an advantage or they just had certain personalities that were good for it, those dogs become more popular and they're more likely to be bred again. So even today, I think this is still ongoing.
Definitely, definitely. Then there's the, you know, the whole evolution of dogs that's going on among street dogs. I mean, the majority of the world's dogs now are not breed dogs or working dogs. They're street dogs. They're right. Living around us, and they're going on their own evolutionary trajectory. So there's a lot going on with the histories of dogs right here and now.
So in what ways or how was dog breeding influenced by humans, and how do we know this?
For me, the most definitive archaeological evidence for people controlling the breeding of dogs is the culling of dogs, the killing of them. Because there's no more stringent way to control which dogs breed and which ones don't by controlling which dogs live to reproductive age. Mm-hmm. So you see globally people slaughtering dogs. And in many cases, this was dogs prior to reaching their reproductive age, which is, you know, around a year, if not to 2 years, at which point dogs become sexually reproductive and able to produce viable living offspring on average. Mm-hmm. So, you know, culling dogs is one part of that. And that may be even, you know, culling them, killing them to eat them, killing them for sacrificial purposes, mm-hmm. Killing them because they don't do those tasks well, right? They're poor at hurting. They're poor at being companions. They're aggressive towards people, mm-hmm. or whatever characteristics that people don't like in them, they choose them for culling, for maybe for sacrifice, maybe for eating. And this is we don't think of it as a domestication practice, but it is like domestication by definition, control yeah. which animals breed with others. I mean, it's definitive, right? Where many of these changes in shape and changes in genetics can be from just adaptation to the human niche. Mm-hmm. Culling is domestication writ large. It's like, I'm controlling you. Absolutely. There's no more absolute form of control than killing someone.
Right. Do you have some plans for further archaeological research on dogs?
Yes, we are, well, in the midst of, you know, COVID travel restrictions, mm-hmm. trying to work on a project looking at the long-term history of dog sledding in the North American Arctic. So this work involves interviews, consultation with Inuit communities in the Arctic. It involves archival work on, you know, the recent history of dog sledding in the Arctic, and archaeological research on dog remains and possible dog sledding related gear, so sled parts and harness parts and dog whips and these sorts of things. So there's a big team of us working on this. The work has been slow because we can't travel to many of the places where we need to go, but that work will be ongoing for the next couple of years. That's our major project on dogs now. And I'm also messing around a little bit with the dog remains from here in Alberta, in Canada, dogs from the prairie portions of Canada, trying to understand their genetics, their lives with people, basically. Mm-hmm.
What advice would you give to young researchers who are interested in studying animal domestication?
I would say to read as broadly as possible on the topic of domestication. Read, of course, the biological literature, the stuff on, you know, the morphology of domesticated animals and the genetics of domesticated animals, but also read the anthropology of regarding domestication, which is very thoughtful and very informative and has lots of interesting kind of convergence and ideas with the biological literature. And I think when you're well informed from the social science and the biological sides of things here, you can really understand that process well. I think those things would be particularly useful for someone starting out studying domestication.
That's some good advice. This has been a very interesting discussion for me, and I think that a lot of our listeners will also find it interesting, whether they're archaeologists or paleontologists themselves or anyone else who is interested in the history of our long-standing relationship with dogs. So thank you very much for taking the time to tell us about this fascinating topic and about your work in particular.
I'm always happy to do it, and everyone is always, I think, happy to talk about dogs because they're such important parts of our lives and our households. And, you know, it's a real pleasure to be able to, you know, study them for a living.
Yes, definitely. Well, thanks again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have a nice day.
All right. You too. Have a good one.
You've been listening to the ArchaeoCafe podcast. For more information and news, check out our website or social media pages. Links can be found in the episode notes or simply by searching online for ArchaeoCafe podcast. If you have any questions or comments for the presenters or guest speakers, we'd love to hear from you. And remember, one of the great things about being an archaeologist is you can talk about dead people for hours, discuss the best way to clean bones, keep digging tools in your trunk, disappear for weeks and come back covered in dirt and scratches. Nobody will suspect you're a serial killer.